Amen. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Jacob's Well. If this is your first time, then welcome into our community. I pray that it's a good chance for you just to fellowship with the group of believers gathered here in this part of town. On Mother's Day of this year, my wife and I were in my house, in our home, and we were fixing up our house, getting it cleaned up, in order for my parents to come over later that day and to celebrate Mother's Day. And we had been going hard cleaning and doing some last-second cleanup. Had been going for a couple hours, and I actually was up in our bathroom and was cleaning our sinks when I heard a muffled, what sounded like gunshots, right behind our house. And unfortunately, it's not an uncommon sound in our neighborhood, and so I didn't really exactly know how to respond. I thought maybe it was just maybe a car backfiring. Well, almost immediately after that, my wife Tammy came running into the room and said that she also heard what she thought were gunshots. And so we proceeded to look out the backyard, and we saw plenty of people out milling around. It didn't look like in any way, shape, or form that there had been gunshots. There wasn't anyone ducking. There wasn't anybody running for cover. So we went back about our normal business of cleaning up. About 2 minutes later, we heard what was, without a doubt, round after round after round of high-powered gunshots. And immediately we knew that something had gone wrong. Couple minutes later, we heard sirens. It wasn't just one or two cops. It was about 10 police cars showing up to the house right behind our house. Immediately, we knew what had happened. There's a young man named Cortez. I want to put his picture up there on the screen. And he was shot and killed that day on Mother's Day. This is a picture from his funeral. He was 14 years old. In fact, you probably heard about it in the papers. It was a young man that was shot and killed over a lawnmower. It was in the news for quite a while after that. As we went out in the neighborhood and started talking to some of the parents to find out what had exactly had happened, it turns out that Cortez had wanted to do something appropriate and fun and thoughtful for his mom for Mother's Day. And so he sent out his mom to go out to a friend's house for the day, and he and a bunch of his brothers and sisters were going to clean up the house. A part of cleaning up the house was to mow the lawn. Didn't own a lawnmower, so they went up to the neighbor's house and asked to borrow the lawnmower. Received permission from what was a man who I believe is in his mid-40s. Again, it's just right behind our house. It's a neighbor that we've seen regularly. And gave Cortez permission to mow the lawn. Well, as Cortez returned the lawnmower a couple hours later, the brother of the man that had given permission was there. But the original brother that had given permission had already left. And an argument ensued. And the man, the adult, was upset that Cortez had been allowed to use the lawnmower. And Cortez did not respond appropriately, it doesn't sound like. He began shouting at the man, and there was a shouting match that went on for quite a while. And Cortez, I think, even ended up dumping out the gas into the ground. Well, there was enough rage built up inside of that owner of that lawnmower that he actually called his son, who was about 20 years old, and said, "Come and get this boy." And so a few minutes later, after that, this young man loaded up two of his buddies, also about 20 years old, and came into our neighborhood and hunted down Cortez. And it was an execution. It was execution style, broad daylight. There was a driveway that when they finally found Cortez, they put him face down on the ground. And his younger sister that we're very close to sat right there and begged for his life. But they stuck a shotgun in his back and shot and killed him right there. Tylin, the sister, was standing right there and the bullets grazed off of her back. Apologize for the emotion, but as you can tell, it's tough. Tammy and I, by living in the inner city, we're used to this, but it never gets old. A couple of weeks later, another young man in our neighborhood was shot and killed. His name is Dominique. He was 12 years old. Tammy and I had been out of town and came back in and had been away from the news for a couple days. And we weren't sure when we heard this what had happened. And we didn't hear anyone in the neighborhood talking about Dominique. And so we just, you know, wondered, you know, what had happened or whatever. Well, it wasn't until the next day when Tammy saw a picture of Dominique in the paper. And again, it's another family that we're very close to. Just lives right on the other side of our house. We'd see him regularly. We'd see his brother. In fact, his brother has been involved with every Hope Center activity that we've ever offered, as has Cortez's family been involved. In this situation, it was another senseless killing. It was a 12-year-old boy that had walked out into his backyard, broad daylight, and a car drove by, just looking to kill, from what it sounds like, somebody that lived on that street. There had been an argument going on between different neighborhoods. He just happened to be right there at the wrong time. I can go and show you the house, and there's bullets sprayed up in the house. And the mom found him, took him down to the local fire station. They tried to revive him, but it was too late. At about the same time, a group of us had started praying through the Psalms. Our focus was on something totally different. Our focus was on drawing closer to God. And we just read a book that probably a lot of you are familiar with called Divine Conspiracy. And he talks about a curriculum for Christ-likeness and talks about enthralling the mind with God. And we felt like that praying through the Psalms would be a great first step to be able to live that out. It had only been a few days when we realized that almost every other psalm mentions in some way God's heart for the poor and his value for justice. In fact, I want to put a psalm up here. And I would ask that we would just read it together out loud. This is Psalm 12. I could have picked many psalms. This is just one example of a psalm talking about this. Help, O Lord, for the godly are fast disappearing. The faithful have vanished from the earth. Neighbors lie to each other, speaking with flattering lips and insincere hearts. May the Lord bring their flattery to an end and silence their proud tongues. They say, we will lie to our heart's content. Our lips are our own. Who can stop us? The Lord replies, I have seen violence done to the helpless, and I have heard the groans of the poor. Now I will rise up to rescue them, as they have longed for me to do. The Lord's promises are pure, like silver refined in a furnace, purified seven times over. Therefore, Lord, we know you will protect the oppressed, preserving them forever from this lion generation. Even though the wicked strut about, and evil is praised throughout the land. There's 150 psalms, and our method was that we would pray one in the morning and we would pray one at night, and just went through day after day. And again, regularly, there was a similar mention. I just want to read a couple other ones here for you. And just listen. This one is Psalms 35. This is verse 10. Lord, who can compare with you? Who else rescues the weak and helpless from the strong? Who else protects the poor and needy from those who want to rob them? Then Psalm 82, verses 3 and 4. Give fair judgment to the poor and the orphan. Uphold the rights of the oppressed and the destitute. Rescue the poor and helpless. Deliver them from the grasp of evil people. Psalm 99, verse 4. Mighty King, lover of justice, you have established fairness. You have acted with justice and righteousness throughout Israel. In doing some background study, just through some of the passages there, the message is simply clear as you pray through the Psalms. And that is that God has an extraordinary heart for the vulnerable in our community, for the poor, the oppressed, the widows, the orphans, anybody that relies on someone else to live a full and fruitful life. And even, in fact, goes on to explain that he defends the poor and he exacts revenge on those that take advantage of them. It also is extraordinarily clear that he expects all of us, as his people, to share the same heart and to live our lives accordingly. Obviously, as I'm sharing here, you can see that there's still a lot of raw emotion surrounding me and the rest of us at the Hope Center regarding some of these deaths that have happened. And I don't know if you followed along in the papers, but it seems like it's almost weekly that there's some mention of our neighborhood and of the inner cities of Kansas City, just in a state of chaos. In fact, today on the Kansas City Star's front page, it talks about the Prospect Corridor, of which our neighborhood is a part, and just talking about the challenges that people have faced. And there's almost so many of them that I think we get calloused to the tragedies that each one talks about. In fact, it was just within the last year that you may have read about a serial killer that was stalking women up and down Prospect Avenue and killed several of them. And those are all within a small, concentrated radius. When Cortez died, I it obviously hit me very hard. And it just for several weeks afterwards, just in the middle of a random conversation, I would just break down and start crying. And again, didn't even really know where it came from, but I was able to pin it back to Cortez's death and just the senseless nature of it. And I think I will forever, till the day that I die, hear those gunshots ringing through and to be able to put together in my head what was going on at that same time. When Dominique died, I got to be honest with you, I didn't have the same level of compassion because I didn't know even how to summon up that energy to be able to do that. It was like my heart, just to protect itself, had shut itself off. My wife reacted actually just the opposite, just kind of in defense mode when Cortez died. And she had had an especially close relationship with Cortez. In fact, it was he that introduced four of his family members to the Hope Center, and all of them met Christ through Cortez. But when Dominique died, it was like the floodgates opened. And it caused all of us just to take a step back and to pray and to ask God, does it have to be like this? What really, honestly, can be done? And then as God's people, what is our role? When Tim asked me to speak a few months ago, he was very gracious, and he offered for me to speak really about anything. But the few times that I get to get up front and share with you guys, I really feel that the best impact that I can make on our community here, this community of God, is to talk about the issue of poverty and injustice, and just to remind us of God's heart for that. And I do believe that there is a way that those things could end. But I will be honest with you that it's risky and it's involved. I will also be honest with you that it doesn't just involve a few committed people that are willing to risk their life and go in and serve, but it involves an entire community of God. A simple definition of what would need to happen is to re-neighbor. What has happened, I believe, as we look at our city, is that largely the poor have been left alone. They've been forgotten. They've been isolated in neighborhoods. And we could actually end most of the causes and issues that lead to the violence and the poverty and the hopelessness if we would, in fact, reorder our neighborhoods. Unfortunately, Kansas City has a long history of just the opposite. It was in the paper recently, and many of you are probably familiar with this, but the original charters in many of our homes in the Kansas City metro area actually had exclusions on there that they were not legally allowed to sell their houses to people of minority status. It would even specifically say African Americans, among others. As integration opened up, the neighborhood where I live, which is near Central High School, was 100% white neighborhood. It was a vibrant, thriving neighborhood. Well, as integration opened up and black families started moving in, immediately, the white family started moving out. It's known in sociological terms as white flight. And for a while, the neighborhood was healthy and strong. But soon afterwards, the black families of middle and upper class status, the ones that had means, that had the ability to go and relocate, they also have flighted out. Many of them in our neighborhood, if possible, many of the families are trying to move to the Raytown-Grandview area. New neighborhoods around Kansas City are not built with low-income housing in mind. They are built usually with all beautiful, nice homes. And so what has happened is that we've created a ghetto. You guys are probably familiar with the term the ghetto, but actually it comes from a World War II term when the Jewish families were excluded from the rest of the city. It was a form of persecution. They were actually walled off and forced to live in a certain part of town. Warsaw is a very famous ghetto. And there's been some different movies that have been documented about that. But the whole point, the whole definition is that it's a group of people that are forgotten, left out, dropped out, and they're isolated from the rest of the healthy, vibrant community. I've been living and serving in the inner city for about 10 years and have just realized that things happen so fast and there's so many obstacles that a few committed band of people will never be able to fully make the difference to turn the tide. In fact, evidence shows that in a neighborhood where there's 30% or higher poverty, all systems break down. Every single social system breaks down because it can't handle the volume of need that has been created. You pick a service. Education, again, is well documented in our paper. As Tammy and I and others from the Hope Center go into the local schools, it's out of control. We probably see less than 10%, and that's even being gracious, of kids anywhere close to their reading and writing level. In fact, only 25% of the kids that ever start high school will ever graduate. Of those that graduate, less than 15% will ever go to college. Of those 15% that do go to college, less than 15% of them will ever graduate. In today's global economy that's a knowledge society, a college degree is becoming more and more of a prerequisite. Substandard housing is the norm in our neighborhood. Every time you hear of a hospital or of another large employer leaving, then that affects people in our neighborhood. A lot of us don't have the transportation to be able to move around and go to jobs all over the metro area. The companies that are left are deluged with requests for employment. Churches even close up and leave. Across the country, every day, a church located in the central part of the city shuts down. And I think part of the issue here is that we as Christians have not ever been fully explained to or taught our obligation to ensuring justice for the poor. I think we generally get the idea that we're supposed to help people, and especially around the holidays, you see ample evidence of that. And the term that a lot of times is thrown around, and it's a biblical term, is the term compassion. But even as you look at the literal meaning of compassion, it means to suffer with. As the biblical writers were talking about caring for the poor, it was unthinkable that people would be caring apart from a relationship with those actual people. Justice is a term that's regularly mentioned throughout Scripture. And it's forced me to go back and to really look and see, okay, what is justice? What is God really talking about when he talks about justice? And very simply, compassion is to suffer with those that are in poverty, but justice is to end the causes that actually hurt people. That's our role. That's our responsibility. Walter Brueggemann is a well-known Old Testament scholar, and he does an excellent job of walking through the book of Isaiah and talking about this issue of justice. And he explains that really the role of us as people is to be a community that's inclusive. All throughout history, there's a group of folks that are just naturally going to be left out. The poor are a part of it. In their day and age, it was the widows, the orphans, because they didn't have access to land, foreigners, or aliens, as they were called. They didn't have access to land. And so it was the part of the believing community to be inclusive to ensure that they had full access to a vibrant life. And I believe that today that's the only way that our neighborhoods will ever truly change. I'd like to read a passage here. This is from Isaiah 58. You can read it out loud again. It just reminds us, too, of how God views what true religion looks like. Let's go ahead and read it through here. Shout with the voice of a trumpet blast. Tell my people Israel of their sins. Yet they act so pious. They come to the temple every day and seem delighted to hear my laws. You would almost think this was a righteous nation that would never abandon its God. They love to make a show of coming to me and asking me to take action on their behalf. We have fasted before you, they say. Why aren't you impressed? We have done much penance, and you don't even notice it. I will tell you why. It's because you are living for yourselves, even while you are fasting. You keep right on oppressing your workers. What good is fasting when you keep on fighting and quarreling? This kind of fasting will never get you anywhere with me. You humble yourselves by going through the motions of penance, bowing your heads like a blade of grass in the wind. You dress in sackcloth and cover yourselves with ashes. Is this what you call fasting? Do you really think this will please the Lord? No. The kind of fasting I want calls you to free those who are wrongly in prison and to stop oppressing those who work for you. Treat them fairly and give them what they earn. I want you to share your food with the hungry and to welcome poor wanderers into your homes. Give clothes to those who need them and do not hide from relatives who need your help. If you do these things, your salvation will come like the dawn. Yes, your healing will come quickly. Your godliness will lead you forward, and the glory of the Lord will protect you from behind. Then when you call, the Lord will answer. "Yes, I am here," he will quickly reply. "Stop oppressing the helpless and stop making false accusations and spreading vicious rumors." Let's see, Julie, if you'll put up another slide here. What I wanted to do was to actually break down our neighborhood and just get to kind of give you an inside look into what an inner city neighborhood is like. This graph here came from the Kansas City Star, and again, it was documenting just the high rate of homicides. We're on pace to shatter last year's pace of death. And the one on the left here is the Kansas City metro area. You can kind of see I-70, I-35, I-435. And then you can see in the middle there those dots. All those dots indicate a place where somebody got shot and killed. Well, as you can tell, they're pretty concentrated in a small area. If you zero in even closer, that red square is profiled over on the right. And then even inside of that red square, which is the part that we would actually call the ghetto or the inner city, there are even little hot spots in there. Well, that red circle right there, that's where I live. That's where my wife and I, Tammy, have lived for the last 7 years. And work with kids and families in our neighborhood. Now I want to give you a tract here that actually shows our actual street. Okay, so this inside of that red circle is our neighborhood. And you can kind of see in the middle there, it says my house. There's a little red arrow pointing to the blue dot. That's at the corner of 3300 Bell Fountain, 33rd and Bell Fountain. You would look at it and call it Bellefontaine, but in our neighborhood we call it Bell Fountain. And some of you maybe have come to the Hope Center before, either for an informational meeting or to do a work project or to be a leader. And the big blue box up there in the top left, that is the new facility that the Hope Center is fixing up on Linwood Boulevard. And it's right off of Linwood and Prospect. And then there is another smaller blue dot down kind of in the bottom middle. And that is the current location of the Hope Center. It's a greenhouse. And again, some of you maybe have been at one of those two locations. So that kind of gives you some perspective. On the left over there, off South Benton, you can see the White's house. That's where Cortez lived. And there was a parking lot or a driveway just two houses down from there, and that's where he was shot and killed. The owner of the lawnmowers just lived on that left side of the west side of the street. So it all was right there in that one little block. Then you go two blocks to the other side of our house, over off of College, you can see another arrow pointing to the Henderson's house. And that's where Dominique lived. And again, we can see both these houses from our front doorstep or back patio. What I decided to do was just pick a neighborhood block or pick our neighborhood block and just go halfway down each side of 33rd. And I just wanted to walk you through just some of the situations that the families face that are living in each of these houses. And if I were to do this, I could go to any block anywhere in the ghetto and it would be a very similar story. I'm not going to say which family goes to which house because I do want to have some level of protection and security, but I also want to open up a little bit and just let you know what's going on. The red houses are kind of high-risk families, and just give you some examples of a couple. A couple Sundays ago, I was sitting in my living room, actually laying down on the couch and was reading a book, and my wife and a friend were out shopping and heard sirens go by. And it sounded like they went kind of right underneath our house. Well, there's sirens that go off all day and all night. And so I'm like, you know what? It's Sunday. It's my day off. I'm tired. I'm in the middle of a great book. I'm not going to get up. I'm not going to really pursue the truck or the ambulance or whatever it is to see where it goes. But it stopped like right underneath my house. So I felt like I should get up and take a look. And look out the windows on 33rd Street. And I didn't see the police car. But what I did see was a man running into my backyard with fear in his face, and he was ducking down. And what was going on was that he was running from the police. And he had been in a police chase and actually lives right on our street, but he had tried to elude the police by going back into his neighborhood, left the car and was running through and was hiding in our backyard. And he ended up being arrested, and it turns out that he had like $40,000 in arrest warrants that had been unpaid. And they have probably 8 to 10 people living in their house, and I think that their family lives in pretty much a constant state of crisis. Another one of these houses here is a family that I have grown really attached to over the years, and they actually have lived in their house for about 12 years, I believe, and so they were there well before I moved into the neighborhood, and by and large, the family is an outstanding family, super nice kids. Some of the girls have just grown up to be this great, great kids. And I went to KU, and their daughter actually got a full scholarship to go to KU. And so we have this bond. But they're moving out. And they say that in all the years that they've lived there, the neighborhood keeps deteriorating. And this is a good family, but they're moving out. Now, the crux of the deal is, though, is that they have a son that they've really never been able to control. And he now is probably about 21 years old. And just the other night, there were bounty hunters knocking on their door in the middle of the night for about an hour, asking them to let them in so that they could arrest this young man. And he is a pretty well-known criminal in our neighborhood. And what's going to happen is this family will move out. They're trying to move to Grandview. In fact, they have a house picked out. And then this young man is going to stay in our neighborhood. And so it's like we're going to lose the really good family, and we're going to keep the member of the family that's causing a lot of problems in the neighborhood. A couple days ago, we had a knock on our door, and there was a little, cute little girl of a family that's moved in within the last year. And she came up to our door and had a little teddy bear. She was kind of shy. She was having a hard time explaining what it was that she wanted. But she went on to explain that she was trying to raise money, and she was wondering if I would buy her teddy bear. And as we started talking a little bit more, she said that her family's power had been cut off, and she was trying to raise money to be able to get the power turned on. As we talked to the mom, we had talked to her just kind of socially. We had never really pried beneath the surface, but she opened up and explained that as a 28-year-old woman, she had four kids and started having kids when she was 15. And her first three boyfriends that had fathered all of these four kids had died. The first two were shot and killed. And then the last one, just earlier this year, died of congestive heart failure at the age of 26. She had just recently taken a job as a hospitality worker in a hospital. And over the July 4th weekend, she wanted to go back home to St. Louis, hitched a ride down there, and had just enough money to be able to get back in time to go to work when the vacation ended. And instead of taking the bus, she had a neighbor, an old neighbor friend back in St. Louis, that offered to drive her back if she would pay that bus money. And so she decided to help the friend out so she could make some money, but then also still have the ride back. Well, the friend's car died before they even got out of St. Louis, and so she didn't have a way home, had no money, no way to get home. And she had just started that job a few days before, and so they weren't real inclined to be able to keep her on, and so she ended up losing her job. And I mean, honestly, I don't know that she's really prepared or equipped to be a great worker long-term at this stage of her life. She wants to go into a homeless shelter and be able to take care of some things, but her kids are just desperately asking her to not leave, and so she wants to stay. And just yesterday, they were over at our house, and they came over with some water balloons and a little deal you put on the spigot to have a water balloon fight, and they started explaining that they had to come over to our house because their water has now been shut off, and so they're carting buckets of water from the neighbor's house over to their house. Another family is on this block here, and a young man just got out of prison. He's probably about 25 years old, and he's doing the best that he knows how to be able to get back on track, but it's tough because he lives in a neighborhood where it's assumed that if you're especially a man, that you're going to be doing something illegal. In fact, you get made fun of in our neighborhood if you do well in school as a kid or if you go off and you work a well-paying job. And so he's stuck. And I could keep going. I could keep going down. I could go to any of these blocks in this neighborhood, but hopefully you kind of get the idea. And I think the thing that we've realized is that 70-30 ratio, the 30% poverty being the max that a neighborhood or community can handle, really bears true. And I think the response is that we would, as Christians, see the need to re-neighbor, and wherever it is that we live, to include the poor in our living arrangements and in our churches. In fact, I have a belief, just in the whole idea of parish, that our city will never really achieve justice and be the best that it can be until we enact neighborhood ways of living. Again, the idea of parish. I believe that healthy, vibrant neighborhoods anchored by healthy, vibrant churches are the only way to really allow people to reach their best, to be their best. There was a book that maybe you're familiar with. Just read it here over the last couple months called Tipping Points, secular book. Fascinating, fascinating book, but had a really poignant reminder for me about the ghetto in there. He talks about that research clearly states that it is better to be raised by a bad family but in a good neighborhood than to be raised by a great family in a bad neighborhood. And that's exactly what you see happening in our neighborhood. Just a couple days ago, we tallied up the number of teenage boys in our neighborhood, and out of 12 kids, 11 of them have either been in jail, are in jail, or there were two that are basically, on their way. Our neighborhood creates bad people. I believe it's because they've been isolated. They've been left behind. And until they're involved and included in a healthy, vibrant community, then it will not change. I don't know where this message finds you. I feel like sometimes when I get up here that I get to or have the responsibility of talking about some pretty heavy issues. But I just see that as a responsibility to maybe remind us or even teach us for the first time of the heart that God has for these people that we've left behind. And not to guilt us into change or to condemn us for what we haven't done, but hopefully to at least inspire us or motivate us to want to take that step and at least let us know what the standard is, what the goal is. I believe it can happen. And as we've prayed through the Psalms, one of the things that we've tried to do, this is at Eugene Peterson's suggestion, is to, in a group of people, just to read the Psalm out loud and then just to sit silently before the text. In fact, Eugene Peterson calls it answering God. He says a lot of times when we go to prayer, we initiate too much of our conversation or dialogue with God. But really, the proper response is to listen, that God, through His Word especially, He's alive and He's active and He's speaking to us. And I'd like to close out our time here by reading another psalm out loud. I've edited a little bit. It's Psalm 72. And we'll read just the first seven verses and then the last three. And then what I want to do is just to have a couple minutes of silence. If we can just sit here quietly, but spirit of prayer, just kind of listen to see if God maybe is saying anything to us. And then we'll move into communion. And then, Julie, when we've read this psalm, if you could put up that other slide that we haven't done with Dominique and Tammy, and we'll just kind of have that before us as we're just praying. So let's read Psalm 72 together. The Psalm of Solomon. Give justice to the king, O God, and righteousness to the king's son. Help him judge your people in the right way. Let the poor always be treated fairly. May the mountains yield prosperity for all, and may the hills be fruitful, because the king does what is right. Help him to defend the poor, and to rescue the children of the needy, and to crush their oppressors. May he live as long as the sun shines, as long as the moon continues in the skies. Yes, forever. May his reign be as refreshing as the springtime rains, like the showers that water the earth. May all the godly flourish during his reign. May there be abundant prosperity until the end of time. He will rescue the poor when they cry to him. He will help the oppressed who have no one to defend them. He feels pity for the weak and the needy, and he will rescue them. He will save them from oppression and from violence, for their lives are precious to him.